I'm John Kroll. This No Limits begins the last 2 weeks in which the show will be on the air. We will spend the final live No Limits shows offering our profound thanks to the best audience in radio, the good people who have listened to us for nearly 9 years. To start, the good folks here at WFYI and IPBS ask that we flip the format for this No Limits and have someone come in to interview me. We've brought in someone special to do that, Eric Bradner of CNN, who also is one of my former students and was the first guest host No Limits ever had. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and on this show, sort of your host, not entirely. The special announcement to begin the program, and that is that No Limits will be going off the air in about 2 weeks. July 11th, in fact, will be our last show. We're going to be making way for a new show here on WFYI that eventually will premiere statewide called All In. It will be hosted by Matt Pelzer, a good guy who is going to be a great choice for the program. That is something for you to look forward to. We want to spend much of this last 2 weeks, these last few shows, thanking all of the folks who have listened through these nearly 9 years and make you know how much we appreciate the attention that you have given us and the consideration through the years. To start off what I am privately referring to as the farewell tour, the good folks here at WFYI and IPBS ask that we flip the format and have someone come in and ask me questions instead, interview me. I'm not sure how this is going to go. There's a reason I've generally liked being the person asking the questions rather than providing the answers. But we've got a special guest, special obviously in his professional attainment, special also to me, Eric Bradner with CNN. He's a senior political reporter there. Also a former student of mine, a good friend, and for those who have followed the show, has not only been a guest here, but was the very first guest host the program ever had. So welcome back to a familiar studio, Eric.
Thank you. Thank you for having me in to do this. I'm looking forward to it. This will be a fun show. We're going to talk about some of your favorite shows, memorable guests, maybe a little bit of politics. And I want to encourage everybody else to call in. I mean, this is called No Limits for a reason, and this is your opportunity to ask John anything and everything that's on your mind. So please get into the conversation. We're at 866-476-3881.
Yeah.
You can email nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI and Twitter at WFYI. So, John, to start off, I want to ask you about the idea of this show now that you've wrapped up a lengthy run. At its best, what have you wanted this to be?
I had more of an idea, a notion than when we started it. I wanted it to be a place where thoughtful people could come together and talk about things that either mattered or just were interesting or, you know, that they cared about and not have it become, a shouting match. I wanted to create a kind of forum in which people would listen as much as they talked, maybe even more than they talked. I used to tell myself when I went on the air, which is one of the reasons doing this show is not entirely, this particular one is not entirely comfortable, I would tell myself, okay, if there ever is a show I do where the audience learns more about me than they do about the subject we're talking about, that's a bad show. That's something that shouldn't be or anything like that.
this show being the exception to that rule.
Yeah, this show being the exception, I hope that proves the rule, but maybe not. We'll see. And then, the other thing, former news director here at WFYI, Michelle Johnson, came up with a phrase that I hope applies to the show that I really, really like. She said, "It's a show that doesn't vent, it breathes." And that's really where I wanted this to go.
As a journalist, you've been interviewing, talking to people your entire life. What have you learned about having those conversations in a productive and positive manner, doing them live on the air?
Oh, well, I learned, obviously, doing it on the air is in some ways trickier than, I my career. I started as a print journalist. And unless you had a deadline you had to get back to file, there wasn't tremendous time pressure. It didn't cost anyone anything if you sat there and waited for someone to collect her or his thoughts before answering. But you can't really do that in radio. Silence is a bad thing in radio. So I learned, among other things, when I could see that it was a tough question and that the person actually was wrestling with it, trying to think through the implications, I learned to kind of just keep talking a little while until you got the nonverbal cue that the person was ready to respond. It sort of arrived at what he or she was going to say. It's what I tell my students all the time, too, that the most important thing in any interview is listening. In this case, it's not just about the listening, but also paying attention to those nonverbal cues so that you can see where people are going and when they're ready to deal with a question that might be tricky or tough.
If you tune in any Tuesday or Thursday, you might hear a local politician, but you also might hear an author or remember a show about meteorologists, for example, lots of different topics. And some of these guests are people who are interviewed fairly regularly. Others don't do this very often. Mm-hmm. And you just talked a little bit about how to help a guest who is maybe searching for the right answer. But what happens when you have one who won't shut up?
Well, you give them a little bit of rope. I mean, in this show and in this format, I've always told people, and actually one of the promos we used at one point during the history is that this is talk radio for people with attention spans. And I always tell the guest, you don't need to make your point in 7 to 8 seconds, that you can speak in paragraphs if you wish, but have a point. If they're wandering, I will step in. I try to do it gently. That's something I kind of had to learn along the way. I think early on, I got a couple of complaints about that I was interrupting people. And I realized, okay, there are ways to do, and that just came out of my natural nervousness about, okay, I'm looking at the clock and all of that, that there are polite ways to do this too, gentle ways. And if you explain to both them and the audience why you're doing it, a lot of that tension disappears.
And a lot of these shows have localized issues that are the topics of national or international discussion. Or invited people who have brought some acclaim, who have sort of made their names nationally, but might have ties to Indianapolis. What's the value of doing something local with a local host and local guests to sort of connect those topics and conversations to people who might otherwise lose them?
Well, I believe place matters. I mean, what. I grew up here in Indiana, as I know you did. It means something to be a Hoosier. It means something The place in which you live shapes so many parts of your life that I'm not surprised that, and I'm not, by the way, arguing, I'm not going to disparage people who live in California or New York or the Deep South or anything like that, because I don't think this should be, you know, a competition or anything like that. But I think it gives people a chance to run it through the filter of their own experience. You know, if you're working or reporting for or doing a show similar to this for a national audience, you know, it means that you can't be specific to place. You know, to do that, to do a show like this and focus it exclusively on Indiana for CNN would be one of the most foolish business decisions around, because you're excluding 49 other states from the discussion. So that's the value of it. I'm not saying you need shows like this to replace others, but I think there has to be there has to be both. There has to be that perspective.
There are good shows, bad shows, and I would imagine some that are surreal.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there's been a time that you've left the studio thinking, I can't believe that just happened, or that we just talked about that for an hour.
Oh, boy. I think probably the most surreal moment was relatively early on. We were doing a show about sleeping disorders, and there was a guy who called in, and, we had a couple of medical people, a guy who called in and said, oh, my problem is that I wake up constantly. I'm going to paraphrase here, so that in a state of arousal. And I looked over after I'd gotten out of the call. Both of the doctors were bent over laughing. So, and of course, I'm fighting back the laughter myself and thinking, okay, somehow I've got to keep getting words out while these guys recover themselves and all of that. But that probably was the single most surreal moment I've had, because of that. Okay, you know, it's sort of like one of those sitcom outtake things where the cast can't stop laughing, because that's pretty much where we were.
On a topic like sleeping disorders, do you ever wonder, how am I going to get an hour out of this? How am I going to talk about this for a long period of time, get the audience involved? Or do you find that some of those shows about random, perhaps unexpected topics actually drive more audience interest?
Well, I think, you know, part of it is what I learned about this is similar to what I learned, even though they're very different kinds of relationships, similar to being a columnist, which I have been for a lot of my professional career, in that the relationship is really important, and that you cannot in any case be dishonest with your audience. So if there were shows where the best example is producers, and they had really high listenership, the producers were absolutely right on this one, wanted to do through the years a fair number of shows on gardening. I know absolutely nothing about gardening. In fact, I probably know less than nothing about gardening. And what I would do is just acknowledge that at the top of the show and say, okay, if there's any other subject like that, and say, okay, you know, if this is one of those things where you're like me, you don't know much about this subject, this is the show for you. Call in if you're afraid the question is going to sound stupid. You won't sound stupid. I will, because I'll be the one asking it. And if you don't want me to use your name, do that. So, you know, I found that was, a good way to keep the conversation moving and invite people in, basically, not just to listen to the show, but to help shape it and direct it and get the conversation going where it should go.
I want to talk a little politics, and we have an email here from Michael Egan. I told people they can ask anything and everything, and this is a specific one. Michael wants to know, seeing as how funding is getting cut to the Hoosier state line, do you ever see Indiana investing in high-speed rail? One would think we could gain from that sort of infrastructure, is Michael's point of view.
I would hope so. I've not really seen a whole lot in Indiana's political culture, just as an observer, that is particularly forward-thinking. We tend to arrive at points several years after everybody else does. Now, one might argue that part of that is that we just want to see if it works other places, but I don't know.
Fair enough. Well, Michael, thank you for the email, and we want to invite everyone to participate as John Kroll says goodbye, beginning of a two-week tour wrapping up No Limits. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. We're back on No Limits at WFYI. I'm Eric Bradner with CNN, and today we're flipping the script. I am interviewing John Kroll. We have a caller, and I think I need to do a disclosure here ahead of time. This is my wife, Jessica Ray Bradner, and she also is a former intern here at the show. Jessica, what's up?
Hey, guys. Hey, Eric. Hi, John.
Hi, Jessica.
First, John, I just want to say thank you so much for this show and for the opportunity that Franklin College students had to intern with this show. My question is, of all the shows that you've done, what has been the most moving or enlightening conversation that you've had?
Oh, boy. There have been a lot of them. I'm thinking of one where, you know, we talked with a young woman who, you know, was a survivor of sex trafficking. And, you know, just to listen to her experiences, you know, people think that with the training, and you guys know this because you both worked in the business, that somehow, if you are a journalist, you become a robot, and that's not the case. I mean, you hope with the training and the professional discipline that you'll maintain some detachment. But when you hear things like that, it can't help but affect you. And that's one that sticks in my mind. We've talked, obviously, with parents who have lost children. As a parent myself, it's impossible not to relate to that. You know, I remember talking once with a World War II veteran over the air who was, and you could tell, you know, 60 plus years after his experiences there, he saw some things that still traumatized him. And, you know, in the course of the conversation, he took us right back to being an 18-year-old kid seeing a bunch of things no 18-year-old ever should have to experience. And it's impossible not to be moved by that. So those are the ones that stick in my memory. Before we let you go, Jessica, I've got to say the description did not do justice. You actually were the only intern in the history of the program who was promoted to producer. And you produced one of the shows. I think that was the show where I almost accidentally hit you in the face, if I recall correctly, right?
Yes.
Yeah. The problem was to fill the audience in here because they won't get the visuals. People, you know, if it's a longer email, the producers, instead of sending it in on a computer screen, will print it out to make it easier for me to read without having to scroll up and down and bring it in and just open the door and hand it to me. And, you know, the producer in those days, most of the time, was Sharon Alseth, who's going to be a guest on the show next week as we continue this. Sharon is right around 6 feet tall. Jessica is about a foot short of that. So I was used to throwing my hand out to get the email at a certain level where Sharon generally presented them to me, and Jessica's was a little lower. I almost clocked her. So I guess that was not. But as I say, you were the only one in the history of the program who was ever promoted to producer. And after your internship, FYI hired you as an assistant producer on the program, correct?
Yes. And thank you and WFYI for the show. It's something that I think has been attractive to everyone from anywhere and any age. There is always something interesting going on, including, I think, didn't you all have John Green?
Oh, yeah.
The young adult novelist from Indianapolis on.
He broke
as well.
The internet for us. He broke the website because he tweeted out he was going to be on the air, and suddenly we're getting calls from Japan and Burma and all of this stuff, and it just everything collapsed.
Jessica was a lot more excited about
that
show
than any other show we did. Well, and I've got to say, that was one of the cool things. I've met a lot of great people. In addition to being, an incredibly skilled writer, he's just a heck of a nice guy, too. So, anyhow, Jessica, well, thank you for calling in, and thank you for your work on the show.
I'll see you soon.
Take care.
Please join the conversation. You can call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, and Twitter at WFYI. We have another call from Andrew. Andrew, what's on your mind?
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I wanted to thank WFYI and John for the show. I think it's important for there to be places and spaces where people can have conversations and you can hear different points of view. Obviously, he's skilled at doing that as a journalist, but I always hope that these things will go beyond that. John, do you have any tips for how the average person might sort of detach themselves from their position on an issue in order to hear what other people have to say?
Well, I think a lot of it does come down to what I said earlier, listening. And I don't think I'm not going to preach a whole lot on this because frankly, I have difficulty believing anyone would care all that much what I think about all of this stuff. But it does strike me that one of the things we have lost as, our capacity to communicate has grown wider, quicker, all of that sort of stuff, is the ability to slow down and listen to each other. And a lot of the forms we use to communicate now don't encourage that. And that, I think, comes down to it. I try to figure out what it is, if someone is upset, what it is that is driving that. Because if you can speak to that, often you can take some of the tension out. And most of us, let's face it, we just like to feel like we're being heard. If we feel like we're being heard, a lot of the anger, the anxiety, and all of that disappears.
John, we have an email.
Thanks very much for the call, Andrew. And the question.
Thank you.
Yes.
John, we have an email from Bruce, and this is a pretty open-ended question.
Okay.
Greatest regret.
Oh, greatest regret. Boy. I'm presuming with the show.
Bruce leaves it open-ended, so I think
I think you always regret more. I don't regret too many things I did, because even if they were screw-ups, I hope I learned from them. Personally, probably the greatest regret I have is that when I was in grad school, I had an opportunity over a summer to work on a barge that was going up and down the Mississippi River. I went to grad school at St. Louis University. And instead, I also was offered an opportunity to come back and write editorials and columns for the Indianapolis News over the summer. It was very, very clear that the wisest professional decision I could make, since I wanted to be a journalist, was to go back to the Indianapolis News and write columns and editorials. But I've often regretted the fact that I didn't get to spend a summer doing 30 days on, 30 days off, traveling up and down the Mississippi. I have a feeling those would have been stories I'd be telling over the radio now, presuming I'd made it to the radio show. Greatest regret with this show probably is that we didn't take it out of the studio more. It's one of those things that, you know, the logistics of that are tough figuring out. It's not just about getting me in front of a microphone somewhere. It's also about how you get all of the other people who do the show. And I would be remiss here if I didn't talk about, you know, I didn't say it isn't just a show. The show is not just about me talking or talking to the people in here. It takes a massive team of people to make this thing work. And, you know, all of them did great work. And I think we're dedicated to the same sort of principle and conversation that we are, you know, that we talked about here, where we wanted it to be a place where thoughtful people could come together.
John, we've got an optimistic email here from Barry, who says he is a long-time listener. There are several O's in this email. Long-time listener. He's saddened to hear that you will be leaving, but he's remembering when Diane Rehm announced her successor. He was skeptical, but now loves Joshua Jackson's show. So he's hoping your successor will be just as successful. So,
well, and I meant what I said at the top of the show. Matt Pelzer is a great choice for the program. He is a thoughtful, level-headed guy who treats everyone with respect. He's going to be a great choice for this. And, you know, I'm going to be listening to him. I hope everyone else will, because I know he's going to do great work. And all of that. So, yeah, I don't think you need to have any worries about that, that Matt is going to do a superb job.
John, both in the studio and in your career as a journalist in Indianapolis prior to it, you've been covering politics for a long time, and I wanted to sort of pick your brain about that. You've seen and known mayors and governors and other Indiana politicians who have come through here. You've known them young and old at the beginnings and ends of their careers.
Which is a polite way of saying I'm getting a little old myself, a little long in the tooth, but that's good. And I'm wondering, fine with that.
over that time period, who surprised you the most?
Oh, boy. Geez, that is a tough one. You know, in different ways I can answer that question. Steve Goldsmith has been a guest on this show several times, former mayor of Indianapolis, ran for governor in 1996 and lost to Frank O'Bannon. And I think it's fair to say he probably would say a similar thing. We had, when I was covering him as a newspaper journalist, a somewhat contentious relationship. My respect for him I always had respect for him, but it's increased dramatically in the years since he left the mayor's office. And, you know, I've written this, and I believe it, that it's a shame often in our political lives that there aren't second acts, because I think Steve Goldsmith now, with some of the lessons he's learned along the way, would be an absolutely superb public servant. I think he learned some things that and has acknowledged that. I mean, some of it's been on the air here, where he's talked about the things he didn't do right, that he didn't get right, the things he learned along the way. And that's the sort of level that I respond to. I always, you know, in terms of other, Mitch Daniels, you know, we have a kind of a weird relationship. He has not been shy through the years when I've written a column or something of sending me notes or calling me and telling me when he thought I was wrong, completely off base. But
he keeps reading.
He keeps reading, and he also always has a point. I mean, I find when I disagree with him, I always have to disagree with him at the premise, the place he starts. Because if you accept his premise, the logic is always flawless. It is at that, and that's the, you know, the sign, I think, of a truly fine mind. You know, the other people, you know, it came before the show, but, you know, I remember having a conversation with Evan Bayh when he was governor years and years ago when I was a young journalist, and he and his wife Susan had tried to start their family, and through the news that she was pregnant had become public before most couples don't want to publicize that stuff. And I wrote a column saying, okay, this is unfortunate, and you know, the fact that they were sort of caricatured as this Ken and Barbie doll thing. It should be a reminder here that these are real human beings, and when they suffer a loss, they feel it just as much as the rest of us do. And he called me after that, and it was, it was interesting because it was a moment when it was just two human beings talking rather than a governor and a journalist, and those are the kinds of things that stick in my head and are surprising.
At risk of making some enemies, I want to ask you the inverse of that question. Who has disappointed you the most, or perhaps fallen short of the promise they've shown at one point or another as you've covered them?
Well, you know, I'm a journalist, so I'm trained towards skepticism. I always sort of start out expecting journalists or politicians to disappoint me, and all of that, and that I probably would say and he hasn't been a guest on this show, but the one I ended up having sort of the least regard for was Newt Gingrich, because I when I interviewed him for the first time, it was clear all he cared about was trying to divide the country and pick up the larger half for Republicans. And, you know, I mean, he'd say that flatly, that what we Republicans need to do is find all of these wedge issues where we know that, you know, we'll pick up and drive those home. And, you know, I remember talking with Richard Lugar after that. He just shook his head and said no. Then later when I interviewed him again as a newspaper journalist, he went off on this rant about what he called professional black Democrats in the House, which was really playing the race card pretty hard. And I looked at him and said, well, what if somebody identified you as a professional white Republican? How would you respond to that? At which point he went pretty well berserk on me and started shouting at me. So, you know, he's the one I would say that I thought, okay, you know, this guy's not all that interested in the greater good for the greatest number of people.
Let's talk about the big picture here in Indiana, because the whiplash is intense. This is a state that voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and now is as red as they come. Mm-hmm. It's a state where the least competitive congressional district in the northeast Indianapolis suburbs is suddenly the most competitive congressional mm-hmm. district as suburban America sort of moves from the right to the left. Where is Indiana going politically? How can you make sense of this sort of veering back and forth?
Well, I mean, I think some of it is that Hoosiers do struggle a bit with figuring out, you know, they tend to feel like they're ignored, and that, you know, and they'll respond. I mean, part of the reason Indiana went for Barack Obama in 2008 is that John McCain didn't come to the state until, and Barack Obama was flying in here constantly to visit. That's not a mistake a Republican candidate has made since then. But it's, so I don't know. I know I'm going to be interested to watch and see, though, because it's always a good story.
I'm Eric Bradner with CNN. We're talking to John Kroll on a Flip the Script episode of No Limits. Please join the conversation. You can call us at 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. or find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or Twitter at WFYI. Please stay with us. We're back on No Limits. I'm Eric Bradner with CNN, and today I am interviewing John Kroll as he enters the last 2 weeks of this show. And John, I want to talk to you about some of your favorite shows. We've talked about some of the sort of oddball or unexpected conversations you've had. Is there one that you just left thinking you'd really learned something that day?
Actually, quite a few of them. I mean, most of them, you know, I mean, we bring in producers have done a great job through the years of bringing in good guests, people who have thoughtful things to say. So it's a pretty rare show where I don't feel like I learned something or heard something that made me think of something from a different point of view. You know, some of the favorite shows, like the show we did that Jessica referenced about with John Green, made me aware in a way that, you know, took it beyond an intellectual awareness to a much more profound one, how small the world is now. Because literally, he tweeted, you know, that he was going to be on the show with all of the contact information. And I kid you not, 30 seconds later, the phone bank was completely filled up. We had more emails than we could handle, and it just didn't stop for the whole hour. As I joked at the time, I didn't have to work at all that program. It was literally just read other people's questions. You know, some of the favorite ones that stick in my head, just because there's a certain poignance to them. I think the last interview that eventually led to the first documentary we did in partnership with WFYI, the interview with Bill Hudnut after he'd been diagnosed with congestive heart failure and all of that, and we knew that his time was limited, went out to D.C. to do that one. The memorial episodes we did recently when Birch Bayh and Richard Lugar died, also because I had tremendous respect for both of those men as public servants, and I think the grief here in the state was profound, and we created an outlet for people to express that was had an awful lot of meaning for me. So I'm resisting it's talking about which ones mean the most. Is sort of like saying which of your children do you love the most. you don't think of it that way, but I remember walking away from those and thinking, okay, I'm really glad we did that, because that's something that has meaning.
We've talked today about the importance of listening and having an open mind. I want to ask where you learned that, where that sensibility comes from. Was there someone early on in your career who, as you're beginning to cover Indianapolis and Indiana, who taught you how to approach people in an open-minded sort of way?
Well, you're a pretty skilled interviewer here. I haven't talked about this a lot. When I was young, my parents got divorced, and they were not... long before the divorce, they weren't happy with each other, and it was clear. Love them both. They're both wonderful people. They just should not have been married to each other. And as a child in those situations, I came to realize I would come into a room and sort of take a read on the emotional temperature. And you learn to kind of look for cues then, and that's followed me through. So a lot of what happened when I started interviewing people was I learned in some ways that adapting those skills was, and the things that I had learned there was crucial, that if I would learn to read things just so I'd know, okay, how do I negotiate my way through the house? I also can learn how to negotiate my way through the interview. And then some of it is both of my parents are very egalitarian people and insisted from a very early age that everyone, not just I, but my sister and my brother encountered, was to be treated with respect. And that that is, I think, one of the most important lessons that anyone could teach a child. So that's where it came from.
And now, as the director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, it's your job to teach your students how to thrive in a news environment in which, you know, we can complain about the effects of negative polarization and social media and the sort of just constant noise, but you have to teach them how to get past that, mm-hmm. how to work in that environment. What advice do you give your students?
Well, you probably remember there was a drill I'd do where it was all about how you manipulate news cycles to create what is likely to be an unfair result for, and it's the stuff you have to deal with, I am sure, you know, 24/7, 365, and all of that. And the lesson is, okay, we had an unfair result here. Whose job was it to make it fair? And there's always kind of, you know, the punchline is, it's your job to make it fair. Everybody else, they've got their own jobs to do. They're trying to achieve, yeah, they're trying to achieve a specific result. Your job is to make sure that you level the playing field as much as possible and everybody gets heard.
And we have a call from
Sam.
From Sam. Sam, what's on your mind?
Well, nowadays with the so-called conservative and liberal media, which makes it a little hard to listen to the news sometimes, I've enjoyed NPR and particularly this show. It just seems like it's more honest. And so my question really is what your thoughts are about the journalistic ethics in today's world?
Well, I think the journalistic ethics, Sam, are pretty much what they always have been. There are superb, highly ethical journalists, just like there are superb, highly ethical police officers, investment bankers, all of that. There are also some bad apples, some people who cut corners. And unfortunately, they do damage to the reputations of the rest of us. I'm not sure we always can control that. And I might add, too, that I think the audience has some, you know, authority, power, responsibility in this situation, too, because it's not like, you know, many of the places, the examples most people use are, you know, sort of the Fox, MSNBC ends of the spectrum there. And those both sort of sprang up as marketing decisions more than they were journalistic. There was a sense that that there was a huge market or an audience out there that wasn't being served. The danger of it, and I should say, I watch CNN the most because of and PBS for obvious reasons, because obviously one of my former students works at CNN, so I have a special devotion there.
We appreciate it.
Eric is here. But I make it a point to watch MSNBC and Fox, too, just like when I first started in this business many, many years ago. And I had subscriptions to The Nation, National Review, The New Republic, from everything all across, and read them all because I thought, you know, you have to expose yourself to as many different points of view. The danger I see in this, and one of the reasons that I think programs like this, and I thank you for your support and for listening for all of these years, and hope you will continue to support. Matt Pelzer is going to take a very similar approach, he tells me. One of the reasons I think is that, you know, what happens is that if you make a marketing decision just to connect with a specific audience, you're not likely to tell that audience things it does not want to hear. And the reality is that we all, you know, whatever our belief system, there are going to be facts out there that should make us reconsider, should force us to think twice. And that that's something I'm afraid we are losing a bit. I don't know if that was an answer to your question, but I'm afraid, Sam, it's the best I've got. If I could figure out how to weigh the way to completely save journalism, I'd probably be the next Bill Gates. So,
thank you, Sam, for the call.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
John, we have an email from Kenny Washington, and it's a very complimentary email about the show. But Kenny makes an interesting point here, referring to enlightened journalism. And Kenny's problem is that in covering the crisis on the southern border, references are made to migrants as opposed to refugees. He thinks Kenny thinks the terminology there is underselling the situation facing these people who are arriving, who have fled desperate situations. And that actually gets at what I think is an important topic. And Kenny, I hope you don't mind if I sort of piggyback on the question. We've talked about listening to people, sort of civility, but there are marginalized people in the United States today who are saying, no, we have tried that for a very long time, and we're no longer obligated to play nice or to wait patiently. We've been doing that for too long. I wonder what you think of that sort of view. Is there a way to hold that view and also sort of play a productive role in the political conversation?
Well, I would never tell anyone else how to approach his or her life or, and I guess Kenny's point's well taken. I mean, I can afford to do this because I'm, professionally secure, white male. No one's going to deny me the franchise, deny me access, deny me all of those things. That I think there are a couple of things with the question in the email. So yeah, I think obviously when I talk about the importance of listening, I think it's really incumbent on people like me who are and have been historically privileged to do a lot of listening. That's our responsibility. And it also ought to mean that we listen when people are very angry and are expressing that anger, because most often anger generally doesn't come out of nowhere. There is a reason for it. And that is important for us to hear if we're going to get to that point. So, yeah, I think, let me put it this way. If I were marginalized, I probably would be screaming and yelling too. It's a different set of parameters in which they operate. I also want to say, I think the point is a valid one. It's interesting, the word choices we make are critical. And that's something I think that is most fascinating about the profession that you and I share right now. Is that's come into play in ways that I have not seen before. We're having serious debates as journalists about, how we deal with an administration that routinely misrepresents. I remember years ago being at a journalistic seminar where Jackie Banaschinski, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, sort of said offhand, don't you wish just once you could say in a story, so-and-so lied today? And it got a big laugh because it was kind of funny. But the reality is that's sort of where we are right now. And many outlets are coming very close to saying, so-and-so, often the president now, lied today. And, that's not a place, if you had asked me 20, 30 years ago, we would ever get, but we're there now.
It's an interesting point. Journalists try not to put themselves in the heads of the subjects we cover, right? We know that someone's making a false statement, but we don't know what they're thinking. We don't know what information they have. But there does seem to be a sort of shift toward this idea that if you know that they should know the truth and they don't tell it anyway, you can call that a lie. We have another call. This one is from Joseph. Joseph, thanks for calling. And what's on your mind?
Hi. As a frequent listener and reader of John's work, you're an Indiana-focused program, and I wonder how you feel about losing our Hoosier iconic identities, like, for example, Strauss, Ayers, and Blocks. Are we becoming too homogenized? And what makes Indiana stand out? So many other cities, like especially New York, they haven't lost any of the department stores, or at least too many, but they are individual, and we're just kind of run-of-the-mill. We're flyover country.
Thanks very much for that that call and the question. Joseph, I'll see. It's a good one, and I'm not sure I have an answer for you that is going to be satisfying. You know, the danger here, from my perspective, is that I end up sounding like one of those old guys who was always walking 7 miles to school, and it was uphill both ways, and it was always snowing. I miss a lot of those landmarks because they do associate, in my memory, Indiana. I think there still is a very distinctive Hoosier voice. It is conservative in many ways, but I think one of the places and part of the, you see the times that we just disconnect is, you know, it was always well-mannered.
Yes.
And it was always decent. We have lost at times in our public discourse, and we're not the only place. This is happening all across the country. That sense of, yeah, okay, we're going to disagree, but we're not going to be disagreeable while we're doing it.
And we have a sense of place.
Yes, yes, very much so. You know, and that's something that I hope we will retain. And you know, obviously, that was part of the thinking in you know, the new show that's going to have a Hoosier focus that Matt Pelzer is going to do. I mean, the All In was chosen in part to signify that it's going to be all Indiana. So, you know, I sincerely hope that. That will address some of your concerns. We're getting close on time here, Joseph, so I'm going to have to let you go, but thank you
well,
very
thank
much
you
for
so
calling.
Much.
Certainly. Take care.
And, John, we have several more positive notes, people who have enjoyed one person described this as a no-hate call-in show. The Hoosier state line has inspired the imaginations of some of your listeners, so perhaps that's a topic for All In to address.
That would be. Thank you. And, Eric, I want to say thank you very much, not just for doing this show, but for all the support through the years, it's meant a great deal to me. I also would like to thank our listeners. Once again, it's a pleasure doing this show for you. I'm John Kroll with Eric Bradner. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.